The average U.S. American is sitting around seeing, you know, people not getting their money out of the banks. People aren't going to be like, oh, is that a globally important systemic bank? Like, they don't know what a GSIB is, right? So, like, all they know is that people aren't getting their deposits. And so, regardless of who their bank is, they're going to go and try to get their money. But the banks don't have your money, right? So, like, if people start to wake up to that fact and confidence is waning in the system, then that confidence has nowhere to go but, you know, further and further down.
From a Bitcoiner's perspective, the thought of a central bank digital currency should scare the shit out of you, right? It's the whole idea of Bitcoin is the fact that you have, you know, complete custody of your asset, right? You can take your Bitcoin, put it in a hardware wallet, and, you know, it's yours forever, essentially.
So we kind of have these like two conflicting dynamics. It's like if the Fed's BTFP is inflationary, which you and I would agree on, and then these other really smart people are saying the financial crisis and the run on the banks is deflationary, like how do those kind of collide? And it's like an immovable object versus unstoppable force, right? It's like which one wins in that collision.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Blockware Intelligence Podcast. This week I have on Caleb Franzen and our very own Blake Davis. Guys, welcome.
Good to be here, man. Right. Super hyped we're finally having a chance to do this. So I know we had some technical difficulties in the background there, but I think we're firing on all cylinders now, so should be a great chat.
Exactly.
I'm very excited to be here, finally able to get on.
Exactly. Yeah, glad to have you guys both. I think it's going to be a great macro and equities podcast. So let's just jump right into it. Caleb, I want to direct the first question at you. We're recording this on Wednesday, the 22nd, March 22nd. And we just had a Fed meeting where the Fed announced a 25 bips hike. What are your initial thoughts?
I think, as the week kind of progressed, that kind of became the overwhelmingly consensus position. I know that there was a fine debate to be had about the Fed pausing, but I think from my perspective, the fact that they, you know, kind of provided enough of an intervention with the BTFP, I didn't necessarily see the need for them to pause. I actually thought if they paused, it would have put the market into a bit of a panic more so than anything else. And at the end of the day, this rate hike in and of itself, we all know monetary policy operates with a long and variable lag. So this actual rate hike that we got today, you know, likely won't actually be rippling through the actual economy or the financial system for 3, 6, 12 months down the line. And so I think the main thing that really kind of stuck out to me was, first of all, Jerome Powell opening up his remarks, talking about the banking situation and reiterating the Fed's confidence that depositors will be made whole and that everything is essentially under control. I thought that was obviously a key aspect there. The second aspect that really stood out to me is the fact that we did get the summary of economic projections. And the kind of pivotal thing from my perspective was the fact that the Fed actually increased their expectation for PCE inflation while simultaneously decreasing their outlook for economic growth this year. And so, you know, we all know that the Fed kind of has this Keynesian model approach towards economics and monetary policy, which basically means that inflation and economic growth have a positive direct correlation. So for there to all of a sudden be this divergence between inflation and economic growth outlook, I thought that was a little bit surprising. And so I didn't see any of the reporters or journalists ask a question about that specific divergence. But if Caleb had his wish and I was able to be there in the room, that's certainly something I would have asked for a little bit more clarity on.
Nice. Yeah. Maybe next time you'll be there to ask around the question. Blake, what about you? Any initial thoughts after hearing Jerome speak and the news?
Yeah. So I thought it was obviously a super interesting, meeting they had, and a lot of people talking about, you know, this is the biggest Fed meeting that we've had in, you know, God knows how long. And I thought it was, you know, kind of interesting to see how they maneuvered about this situation, because obviously there was, you know, a few different, you know, directions they could have gone with it. They could have paused. A lot of people like to think they were going to pause. The market consensus was 25 basis points, like you guys mentioned. There was a slight inkling that maybe they're going to go 50 basis points to kind of, you know, take down some of those inflationary pressures. But obviously, you know, the situation in the banking sector was kind of the overarching, discussion topic that a lot of people wanted to see Powell discuss. And obviously, like Caleb mentioned, he opened up his remarks talking about it. And I think, you know, at first we've obviously you get kind of a knee jerk reaction on FOMC day. But initially it was positive. And I think that, you know, despite the fact that the Fed elected to not pause rates and elected to raise 25 basis points, the fact that they did raise rates is signaling to the markets that the Fed believes the economy is strong, right? If they had elected to pause interest rates, that would be a signal that they think the economy is weak and they kind of need to lay off the gas pedal in terms of rate hikes. But because they've elected to, you know, raise one more time, you know, maybe twice, the market's pricing in another 25 basis point rate hike in May. There's no meeting in April. So, you know, it was kind of interesting that, you know, despite Powell coming off a little more hawkish than expected, they're kind of signaling that the market's stronger than what some might have anticipated with, you know, some of the things we've seen going on in the banking sector. I thought, you know, another thing that was pretty interesting is the fact that this was a unanimous decision. So you might have expected some of the officials to say that, you know, we need to go 50. You might have seen some of them or expected some of them to say that we need to pause rates, but they came out with this unanimous decision to go 25 basis points. I think that, you know, probably behind the scenes, it wasn't unanimous, but the Fed needs to have this united front, especially, you know, in this sort of period where the economy is so uncertain and people are extremely nervous, and people were already extremely nervous in 2022. But now in 2023, when you get these, you know, regional banking concerns, people are really worried. Like, are we headed towards a 2007, 2008 where I can't get my money out of any bank, out of my large bank? Or is this just some isolated incident? And the Fed is essentially indicating that they believe this is an isolated incident. And like Caleb mentioned, like the Bank Term Funding Program, it appears that the economy and the markets are confident in the ability of, you know, the Fed to backstop liquidity and save these regional banks.
But yeah, no, Blake, I think that was very well said. Let's dive into kind of what's going on with the banking system. It's been, you know, we saw Silicon Valley Bank collapse. We saw a lot of the crypto native banks collapse. What do you guys think, you know, is going on with this? And how do you think about the depositor bailouts, I guess, that have been occurring, where maybe the banks will go under, but everyone supposedly is getting all their money back? And Caleb, you can start with that.
Yeah, man, that's, you know, that's the question I think on everyone's mind, right? Is how severe is this impact actually going to be? And I think as of right now, it seems contained because the Fed backstopped, you know, what was that now? Two Sundays ago. So a week and a half ago, essentially. With the BTFP coming out pretty strong with that, you know, joint announcement essentially with the FDIC and the Treasury. And so, you know, I think that had that announcement not been made, we could be in a very different kind of financial economic situation, if you will, because my perspective on this has essentially been that, you know, if most people had never heard of Silicon Valley Bank before, you know, 2 weeks ago. And so if, you know, the average US American is sitting around, you know, the Monday, last Monday, seeing, you know, people not getting their money out of the banks, people aren't going to be like, oh, is that a globally important systemic bank? Like they don't know what a GSIB is, right? So like all they know is that people aren't getting their deposits. And so regardless of who their bank is, they're going to go and try to get their money out. And so it could have turned into a more severe kind of widespread dilemma, if you will. And, you know, we all know that you know, fundamentally how, I don't want to say frail is the right word, but, you know, shit could hit the fan really quick, right? Like, you know, especially when reserve requirements are so low or basically zero. Yeah, the Fed, you know, the banks don't have your money, right? So like if people start to wake up to that fact and confidence is waning in the system, then that confidence has nowhere to go, but, you know, further and further down. So, I think, let me say this, is that, you know, some people were coming out and warning about Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank and Silvergate and so on and so forth. But I think from my perspective, like fundamentally, it's really hard for people to have, you know, made that call on these banks, and kudos to the people who did. I think from my perspective, the kind of model that I've been operating with since I published this in November is this idea of the earthquake effect, which is basically that after massive inflation that we've had, that's essentially the earthquake. And in coastal geographies, what happens after that earthquake occurs is you get the shifting in the tectonic plates and all the water from the ocean starts to recede. And then eventually you get this big tsunami that comes in, right? So in this model of, you know, inflation being the earthquake, the tectonic plate shifting was the Fed's massive tightening cycle. And we're seeing that liquidity get pulled out of the system. All the naked swimmers are getting exposed, if you will. And now what we're starting to see, at least I thought, is that for the first time, we're seeing that tsunami out on the horizon. Because with the failures that we're seeing in the actual banking system, this was kind of the first, you know, non-crypto contagion event that we've seen over the past 12 to 15 months. And so from my perspective, this was, you know, kind of the one that could actually threaten the actual infrastructure of our economy and of our financial system. So far, because of the intervention that's taken place and because the systemic risks, I think, have been somewhat mitigated, we, you know, I think maybe I was a little bit premature to say that that's a tsunami out on the distance, but it certainly could become one, right? And so from my perspective, I don't know who the next naked swimmers will be or when they will get exposed or how severe it will be. But from my perspective, so long as the Fed continues to embark on their tightening cycle, I know that they just injected a lot of liquidity into the system. So this is clearly a changing dynamic, right? But from my perspective, I'd be very surprised if this was the last naked swimmer to be exposed or if it's the last, you know, bank to essentially be exposed and to go under, right? So we're already seeing a lot of stuff coming out about First Republic, and now there's another like small bank that I'd never heard of before that's, you know, tensions are happening there. And so we'll see, right? But I think either way, right, like my position is that we will see more naked swimmers getting exposed. And at some point, one of those naked swimmers won't be able to be intervened, and that tsunami will actually be, you know, coming onto the shore, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a really interesting analogy, and I think that was really well said. Blake, I'm curious to get your thoughts. With all of these, like, effectively depositor bailouts, not bailing out the banks per se, but the bailing out the depositors, do you see that as, I guess, being like inflationary or deflationary over the next 6 to 12 months?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, you know, to answer that, I'd say first, long story short, I would say it's probably inflationary. But to sort of explain that, I think it's helpful to understand what exactly the Bank Term Funding Program is. We've mentioned it a few times, but, you know, I'm sure not everybody on here has a degree in finance or, you know, keeps up with the markets like that. But essentially what's going on is the Fed is exchanging liquidity for securities, right? So banks are short on cash and they need liquidity. So what they're doing is they go to the Fed and they say, hey, we have all of these treasuries or all of these securities or other forms of collateral, and we're going to trade you that for liquidity. So while the Fed is still in this QT regime, and the Fed reaffirmed today that they're going to continue to be in quantitative tightening, but this is essentially QE disguised as something else, right? The Fed is still growing their balance sheet, and maybe you've seen that chart if you're, you know, active on Twitter or active in the markets. You might have seen that chart of, you know, the Fed balance sheet or the Fed net assets. And we saw this massive spike over the last couple of weeks. And that's exactly a function of, you know, the Bank Term Funding Program. It's the Fed is taking on assets or securities or collateral in exchange for liquidity. So because there's, you know, increased liquidity across the markets, you're seeing lower lower bond yields as treasury yields. And because treasury yields are used to evaluate stocks, right? If you have a finance degree, you know a little bit about net present value. If not, no big deal. Essentially, we're using bond yields or treasury yields to valuate stocks, to discount stocks. So when yields are falling, you're going to have a higher present value for stocks, which drives demand for stocks, which over the long term can drive inflation, right? If the investor has more money in their pocket, they might have more money to go out and spend elsewhere. So I would say, you know, by definition, the BTFP is probably inflationary, and the bailouts to the depositors are also inflationary. However, there also are things that are deflationary. Like I would say the USD liquidity swaps are probably deflationary. So the, you know, in concordance with a lot of other central banks that are involved, the Fed is offering swaps on US dollars. So if you're a, you know, if you're a bank in France and you're running into liquidity issues, you can go to the ECB, who's going to work with the Fed to swap your money for US dollars. Which drives demand for the dollar, which is deflationary. So there's, you know, a lot of dynamics, and it's very complicated, but I would say overall, I see it as inflationary. But I'd love to get Caleb's thoughts too. Maybe he disagrees.
I think for the BTFP, I'd absolutely agree with what you said, because like net, an increase in liquidity and Fed intervention and stimulus essentially is going to, you know, increase the money supply. And if we get a follow through in fiscal stimulus and a follow through in lending activity, that's likely going to produce an inflationary outcome. I think if we just kind of more broadly think, like, so I think we're in full agreement there. I think the thing that needs to be expanded on is, it's interesting because I've noticed in different conversations that I'm having about this, like Bitcoiners are going to, you know, view this in one way as inflationary. And I think some people in kind of like traditional finance view this as very like deflationary, right? And in particular, like, oh, there's a financial crisis, there's a run on the banks, that's deflationary. And like, dude, I have no idea, right? Like, I'm not sure. And so we'll see how this evolves, right? So we kind of have these like two conflicting dynamics. It's like if the Fed's BTFP is inflationary, which you and I would agree on, and then these other really smart people are saying the financial crisis and a run on the banks is deflationary, like how do those kind of collide? And it's like an immovable object versus unstoppable force, right? It's like which one wins in that collision. And like, we're 2 weeks into this, we're a week and a half into this. Like right now I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think you guys both made some really good points. Honestly, I'm also not really sure. I don't know if it's necessarily inflationary or deflationary. I know one guy that I follow that's by no means a Bitcoiner, I think his handle is like FedGuy12, and his name's like Joseph Wang. He's talked about months before all of this saying that it's possible that the Fed remains like hawkish in the sense that they're going to continue raising interest rates and continue to keep them high, but they're going to open up all of these like random facilities that effectively lend money or create, however you want to say it, create money for like the sectors of the economy that they think are like important, right? So like that's kind of what they've done with the banking system. And so maybe they're going to be able to like tap dance and say like, okay, we're going to keep the banking system highly solvent, but then other industries like crypto or FTX or nonsense or high growth technology companies, let's let them fail so we can focus on maybe like the core industries that everyone needs, like energy and food and banking. I don't know, like, am I off the mark there? And or does that seem fairly accurate?
No, I think you're right, because, you know, I've had a lot of conversations for years about people saying, well, what's the Fed going to do next time? They've already done QE. And it's like, look, they have so many tools in their toolbox that we have no idea about. That they could, you know, step into the market and essentially intervene and provide some form of stimulus, right? And so this BTFP, like no one was talking about the Fed rolling out some sort of facility like this, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks ago. And yet here we are today, they just injected $300 billion of liquidity into the market, right? And so, you know, in a way, I was lucky enough to work in banking for about 2 years as a commercial portfolio analyst. And part of that time was during the onset of COVID and the pandemic. And so I got to kind of see firsthand how the Main Street Lending Program was introduced and, you know, essentially offered, which was, you know, the Fed coming in and lending directly to the bank's borrowers, right? And so that was another form of, you know, essentially monetary stimulus that we had never seen before, because, you know, theoretically, these loans were supposed to have very attractive financing terms. At the end of the day, this facility was an absolute mess, and they ended up, you know, cutting it, and it just essentially flopped. But exactly right. Like this, at the end of the day, the BTFP and any other form of future intervention that they could roll out with these types of facilities isn't something that is necessarily new, and is something that we should actually expect to see most likely if this continues to unfold.
Yeah, I also wanted to, you know, reiterate something that Caleb mentioned earlier, and that's the lag that it has, that monetary policy has, and all these decisions have on the markets and just on inflation in general. It's not like because the Fed, you know, rolled out BTFP that we're going to get a, you know, 10% CPI reading in March, right? That's crazy. That's not exactly how it works. And it takes a ton of time for just even market forces to actually go and impact the day-to-day consumer, right? Because you can have monetary inflation, but it doesn't really have the same impact that it has when you go to the gas pump and your gas is 14% higher than it was a year ago. So these things have a long lagged effect. And like Caleb mentioned, I have no idea. Like, I think in theory, it's inflationary, but whether or not that's the actual effect it has on the markets, nobody knows, and we likely won't know for a very long time.
Yeah, I think you guys both made some great points. Obviously, this is a Bitcoin podcast, and I definitely want to get into Bitcoin later on. But before we do that, I'm curious from both of your perspectives, and maybe we can start with Caleb. Where else would you recommend or say that investors should be hiding right now? Like, I feel like it's difficult. To me, like, the narrative for Bitcoin is set up really well. And obviously, you know, throughout the start of 2023, Bitcoin has performed exceptionally well. But if you take Bitcoin out of the equation, what's another good place to potentially hide if you're not a Bitcoiner?
I think Bitcoiners are probably going to cringe at me saying this, but I really do like the 6-month treasury. So, you know, you're basically able to lock in 4.9% on that sucker. And, you know, there's obviously going to be some duration risk, but very minimal, right? And so it's like, this isn't a trade to, you know, sell this bond at a higher price. This is simply to collect an annualized yield of 4.9%. And so over a 6-month period, you know, if you're generating, what's the math on that? Basically 2.4 something percent. Yeah. Hey, that's really attractive, I think. And so, that's for me, very attractive. I have been buying some money market funds through Fidelity, who's one of my brokerage accounts. Because again, that's like no minimum 4.3%. So, you know, if you kind of want to diversify that, you know, risk essentially of who the, originator is, that's one way to do that. And I mean, at the end of the day, cash is king, especially in a period of high uncertainty. So, you know, I'm, you know, happy to say like I was, you know, trimming some equity exposure in favor of cash. And, you know, I did repurchase some equities again yesterday, but less than I sold in the prior week. And so for me, I think, you know, you can kind of take this well-balanced approach of, you know, seeing like zooming out away from the tree and just looking at the actual forest itself. Like I'm 27 years old. All I know is I need to be buying assets, because if that dollar continues to be devalued over time, all assets, whether it's Bitcoin or treasuries or equities, in my opinion, real estate, are going to go higher over the long run. So I need, I want to retire young. So, you know, got to get that wealth up, baby.
What do you think, Blake? Where else should investors be hiding if they don't necessarily think Bitcoin's the play?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I agree with Caleb. That was, you know, the first thing that came to mind was those, you know, short maturity treasuries. Obviously, you know, with yields rising to where they're at now, it seems kind of like a no-brainer for, you know, a 6-month, a 3-month, maybe even a 1 year to lock in, you know, those sort of gains. It seems to me like a no-brainer. I think, you know, outside of that, obviously it depends on, you know, your time horizon and your risk tolerance and things like that. You know, I don't mind moving into equities here. I don't mind moving into Bitcoin here. I think, you know, all these stocks trading at a 70% discount is obviously a great buying opportunity for the long term. However, in the short term, price action, you know, who knows where we go from here? You know, it seems as we're recording this, and as that kind of looks like it's rolling over, and maybe we kind of have another leg lower here. I'm not saying we necessarily take out the bottom, but, you know, maybe we just kind of have a little dip here, and just kind of let, you know, funds kind of regain their footing. It's been a pretty confusing period of time. It's also been interesting to watch gold here. I'm not necessarily like a gold bug, and I'm not necessarily recommending anybody goes out and, you know, buys a gold ETF or anything like that. But it's been interesting to see that as we've, you know, seen a drop in bond yields, we're also seeing this correspondence jump in gold. And it seems to me kind of like this textbook recessionary price action. And I would love to get, you know, Caleb's thoughts on this as well. And Joe, if you have any thoughts, but it seems to me like what you learn in school is that during recession, you get a ton of demand for treasuries, you get, you know, a ton of, or less demand for equities, and you get more supply for gold. And it seems like over the course of the last couple of weeks, as economic concerns are more heightened than they've been, in an already, you know, extremely economic uncertain era or just period of time, it's been pretty interesting to see, you know, the dynamic of price action that's been shaking out.
So if I can really quick on the point for gold, I was on a Twitter space like yesterday or 2 days ago, and this guy was talking about how gold has a positive correlation with real yields. And I was like, dude, that's the exact opposite of what's actually true. So here's the thing. We'll do a quick little macro 101 here. Gold has an inverse relationship with real yields, right? Because think about it this way. If real yields are going up, and I can essentially, right, real yields are basically nominal yields minus inflation. And so if I can generate a higher real yield on my dollar, I'm going to want to have those dollars to generate that higher real yield. So all assets go down in a higher real yield environment. So gold, especially because it has zero cash flows, which is something that, you know, equities do have, that's something that bonds do have. Unfortunately, Bitcoin doesn't have those cash flows either, right? Unless you're a miner. So, you know, gold has zero cash flows. So it's very inversely correlated to real yield. So gold needs real yields to fall. So how does that happen? Two things. We can have inflation decelerate and continue to decline, which is essentially what we're seeing. That's disinflation. That's what we've basically been in for sure since November. And second of all, we can have nominal yields decline. And what have we seen over the course of the past few weeks? As uncertainty rises and investors increase their demand for bonds, those yields come down dramatically, right? As we start to price in lower economic growth, those yields come down dramatically. As we start to price in more disinflation, those yields come down, right? So this is an environment for gold to thrive. I left my gold bug days back in 2018. So, you know, it's very hard for me to encourage people to go out and buy gold. But I will say, if there is an environment for gold to do well, it's likely what we're in right now. And essentially, gold got back over 2000. I think it was yesterday, quite briefly. But, you know, price action is confirming that, right? So gold has an inverse correlation with real yields.
Yeah, very interesting points. And yeah, I definitely would say, personally, buy the digital version of gold known as Bitcoin. but yeah, no, I think that was really well said. And one thing that you guys both said about T-bills, I think that's a great point. Like, I know BIL, which is like a treasury bill ETF, it's something that I have personal exposure to. I think that combined with a ton of Bitcoin, it creates, like, in my opinion, a very good portfolio for if you have a long time horizon. So yeah, I think great points by both of you there. Foundation is one of my favorite Bitcoin companies. Their product Passport is one of the best Bitcoin hardware wallets on the market. It is air-gapped and highly secure. I strongly encourage you to go to foundationdevices.com and use the code BLOCKWARE and get $10 off your Passport. It's a great way to easily and securely store the private keys to your Bitcoin. I kind of want to shift the topic to the Fed balance sheet. So with this new program, the credit facility that they created, we've seen like a pretty significant tick up in the Fed balance sheet. And you kind of saw this, I guess, occur back in 2019, right, kind of before 2020, and then obviously like 2008, 2009, and kind of either it marked bottom or marked like a changing point where, like, over the next 12 to 18 months, the Fed's going to be pretty accommodative at some point and markets are just going to go on another major bull run. Do you guys think that, you know, is this time different? Like, just because it spiked up, maybe we're going to still like go sideways for a long time and maybe not get easy money conditions? Or do you think, you know, it's going to kind of repeat where eventually we're going to go into another pretty large bull market again?
Blake, do you want to take this one? I'd be curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, sure. You know, I think it's, you know, one thing that should be noted first is that, you know, price action and monetary policy are, you know, extremely different, right? It's the saying that, you know, the Fed, you know, drives the car forward, you know, looking in the rear view mirror or whatever the more elegant quote is. And markets are forward looking, you know, based off of the expectation of future interest rates and just future economic conditions as a whole. So generally speaking, it's hard to make investment decisions based off of, you know, a one-off, you know, Fed decision or something like that, or just seeing, you know, an uptick in the Fed balance sheet. It also, you know, kind of depends on, do you think the Fed balance sheet is going to continue to rise as a result of, you know, banks, you know, taking hold of the BTFP? Are they going to continue to borrow liquidity and increase the size of the Fed's balance sheet? I think there's, you know, a lot of different ways this could go. I'm structurally, I believe that the markets probably have a sideways period. Obviously, we've had, you know, a sideways period for the last several months. But, you know, I still think it's very possible that, you know, the market doesn't just have to go up or down. The markets like to consolidate. And in this period where everybody is seemingly doesn't know what's going on, right? Like this week, price action was a lot of just people waiting for the Fed to make a decision. So the market is very reactionary nowadays. So I would say it's pretty tough to, you know, make a prediction of, you know, the Fed balance sheet rising means that, you know, markets are going to go up from here. I think the Fed balance sheet rising could drive more inflation. And in 2007, 2008 wasn't a highly inflationary period compared to today, right? So the economic dynamics are very different there. So the market reaction could also be very different. I think that people nowadays are more aware of economics in general. It seems like 2021, 2022, everybody became a macro expert. So everybody is extremely concerned about inflation nowadays. And when you see the Fed balance sheet rising, I think more people than ever understand that that creates inflationary pressures. And I think that could sort of drive this sideways period of price action that I would imagine we get. But, you know, of course, I don't have the, you know, the magic crystal ball as much as I wish I did. So I'd love to get, you know, Caleb's thoughts too.
So it's super interesting because I've tried to like think a little bit, like if I was a bank and, you know, I had super low reserve requirements and I needed deposits that I don't have, right? Like, you know, okay, so I would 100% be taking advantage of the BTFP and say, hey, I can finally get these, you know, treasuries off my balance sheet. I can, you know, lend them, or, you know, I can borrow with these as collateral with the Fed. And so I think one thing that's important for us, like that we could do essentially is think, right? Like if yields are higher than they, like in the future than they are right now, there's going to be more incentive for those banks to be taking advantage of the BTFP because they can get capital today and give away that treasury, which is now lost value for par, right? Because that's how this swap is essentially occurring with the Fed. And so it's only going to be when yields are significantly lower than they are today that demand for the BTFP facility is likely to go down, because as those bonds appreciate in value from the yields plummeting, then they're going to want to hold those treasuries again, right? Because, hey, cool, I can now generate a strong yield on that treasury relative to what the market is able to get, and I can actually sell this now at a good price instead of having to borrow against it, right? It's a completely different transactional opportunity set. And so I think if rates continue to stay elevated, you know, like I'm very focused on the 6 month, right? So that's basically been, I think they got as high as around 5.13, 5.15%. As of today, you know, earlier this morning it was 4.97. Now, as of, you know, this afternoon, it's basically 4.9. And so I think it would take significantly lower 6 month treasury yields for the BTFP facility to have, you know, slower demand, if you will. And so long as, I think, in my opinion, if the 6 month stays above like 4.3, let's call it, or even like 4.45, then BTFP demand should be very strong, which means that liquidity will continue to get injected into the system, right? And so I think we're certainly at an inflection point now, because, you know, the Fed is still conducting balance sheet runoff, right? They're only capping their reinvestments of treasuries and MBS at, I think, 30 or 35 billion a month. And so they're rolling off the other amount that's actually maturing. And so if the amount of uptake from the this is getting like super complex, but I know if the amount of uptake of the BTFP exceeds the amount that's being rolled off the balance sheet, then net net, the balance sheet is going to be increasing in value, right? And so theoretically, based on that outlook, like I've done so much research on this, what we would expect to see is that high volatility assets are going to, or high beta assets are going to outperform low volatility assets, right? So this essentially means buy tech stocks, buy long duration, and start selling your value dividend stocks, right? So that's essentially the play right now based on that fundamental outlook. The thing is, we're also teetering and walking this fence of, oh shit, something might actually break, right? Because that's essentially what happened the week and a half ago. Something actually broke, but the Fed was able to put a Band-Aid on it and stop the cut. But what happens, you know, if like we like tumble off the playground and we're like breaking legs and arms? Like that's a totally, like that's going to take time to heal. You can't just put a Band-Aid on it. So we're like walking this very thin line where shit could hit the fan super quick and all of a sudden, you know, risk is just selling off entirely. But if we somehow avoid that and net net liquidity is rising, we should expect to see high beta outperform low volatility.
Yeah, I think this is a good spot to talk about Balaji's pretty wild hyperinflation in like 90 days call. Because kind of like, I guess going off of what you were just saying, you know, like things got bad, you know, and the Fed opened up this facility, but Bitcoin ripped, right? Because they came in with extreme firepower and ripped. And I guess from Balaji's point of view, he's saying that like maybe like that credit facilities like this could kind of become like a very negative feedback loop where like if inflation expectations rise more, then maybe those long duration bonds sell off more and then they have to, you know, borrow more money from the future through these credit facilities and then bonds sell off even more. And then there's more and more money being created potentially. I don't know. What do you guys think about his pretty crazy hyperinflation call?
I mean, I thought it was kind of hilarious. I don't know if I, you know, necessarily agree with the, you know, 1 million Bitcoin as much as I want to. But, you know, I don't really have like a ton of, you know, thoughts on it. I think it's, you know, kind of, you know, crazy a little bit. I think the 2020s could end up becoming, you know, a decade defined by inflation. I think that's, you know, certainly possible. And that's something that we've already seen to an extent. But that's if the Fed's policy isn't going to be enough to cause deflation, right? And as Caleb was talking about earlier, we've already seen disinflation, but that's a lot different than deflation. Deflation is what you see during a recession where prices are falling. Disinflation is where the level of inflation or the inflation growth rate is beginning to decline. So we're still seeing prices rise. When you have a positive CPI value, that means prices are still rising year over year, but because we're seeing a slow in the growth rate, it just means that prices are rising less than they were last month in comparison to last year. So we're seeing disinflation. We're not yet seeing deflation. I think it's something that is very possible that we could see. Like if you look at monetary supply growth rates, right? If you look at M1 or M2 year over year growth rate, we're dipped down into the negatives at the lowest level that we've seen in a long time, since at least the 70s when the data I'm looking at, you know, started. So, you know, that can have a massive effect on the market, and historically speaking does have a massive effect on the market. When the amount of monetary liquidity in the system is declining, you're going to see less demand for assets, both financial assets and, you know, gasoline at the pump or, you know, eggs at the store or whatever it is. And it creates this snowballing effect of falling prices equals, you know, lower revenue numbers, which equals, you know, I need to fire employees and, you know, falling real estate prices and all these things combined together to, you know, result in what we call a recession, you know, or the, you know, declining phase of the short-term debt cycle, or, you know, however you want to phrase it, you know, that the outcome is the same, and it's a decline in economic activity. So the question is, you know, is the Fed's, you know, tightening cycle, or, you know, this period where financial conditions are, you know, severely tight, historically speaking, is that going to be enough to drive prices? Or is the, you know, supply side issues and the result of fiscal stimulus in 2020 and 2021 and, you know, 0% interest rates throughout most of 2020 and 2021, is that going to outweigh what's going on currently today? You know, of course, I don't know, but I think that the deflation is just as much of a concern, if not more of a concern, than the inflation is.
That was a super, super great run through. I think I did see, I mean, at this point, everyone's seen Balaji's, you know, thread and his outlook and the bet of 1 million Bitcoin in 90 days. I think we'd have much bigger problems on our hands if that actually came to fruition, right? So in a way, like, you know, first of all, I don't own nearly enough Bitcoin for that to really pay out for me. And second of all, you know, we probably have much bigger problems on our hands. So, you know, I'm hoping that prediction doesn't come true in 90 days, but maybe over the next, you know, 3, 5, 10 years, 100%. I think, you know, I listened to some of the podcasts that he's been on where he talked a little bit about this like hyperinflationary outlook. And for me, I have a really hard time getting on board with the hyperinflationary viewpoint right now, because I think fundamentally my view is that Fed stimulus and QE and an increase in their balance sheet, you know, is kind of the first stage of setting up for an inflationary cycle. But in order to actually have inflation materialize, you also need two other components after that, which is fiscal stimulus and lending activity, right? And so, you know, if, you know, like Peter Schiff, why did so many people get the inflationary call wrong after the great financial crisis? Because they were only focused on the monetary stimulus. But, you know, for right or for wrong, Barack Obama did not have fiscal stimulus, right? He increased regulations, he increased taxes, corporate profits weren't accelerating at the pace that they were prior. And so we didn't get the follow through in fiscal stimulus. The second part of that is, or technically the third part is, we also didn't get an increase in lending activity after the great financial crisis. Banks were licking their wounds and they were very hesitant to extend their balance sheet. Let's contrast that with what happened in 2020. It was the exact opposite. We had an even larger monetary bazooka that was launched, the greatest fiscal spending basically since World War II, and we had a massive increase in lending activity. We hadn't seen loans and leases grow at this pace in decades. Commercial and industrial loans growing extremely fast. We, you know, consumer loans growing extremely fast. And so we had this multifaceted approach of all of these dynamics taking place. And so from my perspective, even if this, you know, BTFP thing gets really out of hand and usage really picks up and the Fed's balance sheet really starts to go vertical here, you know, yeah, we might get some of that follow through in fiscal stimulus. I don't think we've necessarily seen it yet. And if that BTFP is increasing because of banking risks. Banks aren't going to be extending their balance sheet when they're, you know, hunting for deposits to, you know, pay people out. So I don't think we'd get the follow through in loans and leases that we would need for the actual inflationary cycle to come through. We might get it on the fiscal side. That's, you know, debatable, but I certainly don't believe that we would get it in the actual loans side of things, right? We wouldn't get it in lending activity. And so, like, because when the Fed conducts QE, they're essentially providing banks with a reserve asset. That's not actually like the money printer, you know, going burr, so to speak, right? And the banks need to lend out against those reserves essentially in order for the money to enter the real economy. So this is why, like, from my perspective, QE only benefits, you know, we get financial inflation. We don't necessarily get consumer goods inflation if it's just QE. And so I think the conversation would really need to be focused around these other aspects around fiscal stimulus and lending activity in order to actually predict if we're going into a, you know, a hyperinflationary period.
Yeah, I definitely tend to agree with both of you there. And last kind of topic, and we'll go ahead and wrap this one up, so we both got to drop. I kind of have this theory that Balaji may not necessarily believe that, like, the hyperinflation is coming, like, right around the corner, even though that's what he said. He's kind of using that as maybe, like, more of a marketing ploy, because he thinks that the FedNow program is launching in July and more people are starting to talk about CBDCs. And I think he might think that Bitcoin is, like, the one life raft that people can use that can be out of the hands of governments. And if they do launch this FedNow program and do other regulations around the banking industry, which is obviously becoming more consolidated now that all the crypto banks are basically eliminated, maybe there's going to be some sort of crackdown, and he wants to get people on the life raft before they can't get on the life raft anymore. Do you guys have any thoughts about that, or what do you think?
I'll take this one super quick.
No, I think,
go ahead, Blake. Go ahead.
You can take it. No, I was just going to say, I feel like the marketing ploy seems like the most likely scenario, you know, in this case. But, you know, if you do think that he's, you know, using it to advertise Bitcoin as a life raft, you know, in the face of an incoming CBDC, I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, there's, you know, and the CBDC discussion, interesting enough, or I guess unsurprisingly enough, has become extremely political. But I think, you know, from a Bitcoiner's perspective, the thought of a central bank digital currency should scare the shit out of you, right? It's the whole idea of Bitcoin is the fact that you have, you know, complete custody of your asset, right? You can take your Bitcoin, put it in a hardware wallet, stick it in your closet, and you know, it's yours forever, essentially. The fact that the difference with the CBDC is kind of, you know, similar to what we saw in Canada with, like, the trucker protests, where there, if, you know, if you're involved with something that the government does not agree with, then boom, they just wipe your bank account. And of course, there's benefits to this, right, for preventing crime and all these different things. But it is, you know, a slight concern. And I do have faith that the, you know, U.S. government is overall ethical and has the best interests of their citizens at heart, of course. But it creates some sort of risk that, you know, at some point in the future, something could happen where, you know, people who disagree with the current political party or whatever the scenario is, you know, could have their, you know, bank accounts wiped or whatever the scenario may be. So I think it's, you know, honestly, a great advertisement for Bitcoin, you know, heading into the future.
Great points there. I think I'll take it a step further. It was a marketing campaign for himself, right? You know, that tweet, I think, alone got like 12 million impressions. And so, you know, I don't know how his follower base increased thereafter, but I'm sure he certainly benefited from the additional exposure, right? And there's no such thing as bad press, essentially, right? So it can be the most, and in fact, it's actually encouraged, right? It's like, just say the most ridiculous stuff online and you'll probably benefit from it, right? And so controversy, you know, creates attention, and attention creates more value online, essentially, right? So I think it was probably a little bit of both. It got his name and his brand out there a little bit, and he made a bold call. And if miraculously he's correct, then it's like, dude, this guy just gets catapulted into, like, you know, the top shelf of Bitcoiners, essentially, in the public sphere today. And so, you know, and then if he's wrong, it's like such an outlandish claim. Like so many people like us who are all Bitcoiners are kind of like laughing off the prediction. And, you know, it's like, yeah, dude, like that was never going to go. So it's like, there's no loss here, you know, for him to make this kind of call. So, it was interesting. I still need to dig into it a little bit more myself, but just kind of thinking through it, you know, a little bit like fundamentally, it's hard for me to get on board with the call, but I do think, you know, like his points on FedNow are super valid and the concerns there. Like I think all three of us here and, you know, 99.999% of Bitcoiners are going to be extremely anti-CBDC, right? We don't even need to go into it, right? It's just self-explanatory. So just continues to highlight the value of Bitcoin and the permissionless monetary network it is. So, you know, that's why we're here.
Yeah. I did see someone like retweeted some of his like COVID threads from like January of 2020. So he did kind of predict COVID pretty well and lockdowns and how bad it was going to be. So that was kind of interesting, but obviously just because you have one major hit doesn't mean your next major hit's going to be a big one. But I think it's a great spot to wrap it up. Caleb, we'll start with you. Where can people learn more about you and some of the work that you've done? And then we can go to Blake.
Yeah, check me out on Twitter, just at Caleb Franzen. We're growing pretty well over there, and I'm sharing a lot of data and charts, whether you like technical analysis or Bitcoin or stock market or macro. That's, you know, I'm posting all that stuff over on Twitter. And then I write a free newsletter that comes out every Saturday. That's cubicanalytics.substack.com. Called it Cubic because I, you know, still kind of operate on those three pillars with macro, the stock market, and Bitcoin. So if you're interested in one or all three of those things, each free edition is going to have something for it. Something in it for you. So definitely check that out on Substack.
Blake, how about you?
You guys can find me on Twitter at BlakeDavis50. And I'm also, you know, a co-author of the Blockware Intelligence newsletter with Joe. Highly recommend going subscribing to that. Also, Cubic Analytics is awesome. I read it every Saturday. I'm a subscriber to Caleb's, you know, paid version as well. I think it's awesome. So, you know, definitely go check out both of those. I think, you know, between those two newsletters, you're pretty much caught up on, you know, everything that happened in the markets for the week or, you know, the major market movers. So, you know, follow me on Twitter, check out those newsletters, and I appreciate, Joe, you having me on.